M. What about Straker and all the other organics inside your hull? If the process fails within Victory, or creates something uncontrollable, or that, we'll escape through underspace and leave the greater piece of you to his fate. Does that satisfy your urge to sacrifice yourself for us? Vic raised a metaphorical eyebrow. My purpose is noble. Don't be sarcastic. We apologize. We don't want to lose you. This is war. We lose people. It's worth the risk. Do it. Launching. Trinity fired the probe that carried the Mind Spark device, aiming it as deep into Victory's command sphere as possible. Unfortunately, this probe was small and slow compared to a military missile, an automated point-defense weapon from the home fleet corvette House Finch, speared it instantly. Its remnants crashed into Victory's exposed innards. Straker stared out the flight deck door into the cloud of debris. "Loco! Answer me!" Loco's mech suit emerged as the dust cleared. He launched himself at Straker and sailed across the gap, but too slowly. Straker saw at least a dozen corvettes within his view, their weapons all pointed his direction. All they had to do was fire and kill Loco just like they destroyed that little missile Trinity launched. Apparently their automated systems didn't see a mech suit as a threat, though, and the organic operators didn't react fast enough or they chose not to fire. Loco's mech suit shot through the door and crashed to the deck as soon as the grav plating exerted its pull. "Go, Trinity!" Straker yelled into his comlink. "Get us out of here!"
"Not yet, Liberator," Zaxby said. "We're engaged on a much wider front than you understand."
"What the hell's that supposed to mean?"
"We had Vic aboard. Now he's gone back to Victory, and we're trying to take control of the home fleet squadrons. We launched the Mind Spark device, but its probe was destroyed. However..."
"Mind Spark device? You had Vic aboard? He went back? Zaxby, you're babbling."
"I'm explaining as fast as I can. If you were in your suit, I could download all this information to it, and your brain chips could help you keep up, but that's gone, so for now, just listen."
Straker bolted across the deck toward the spare mech suit. "Thanks for reminding me. Keep talking."
Zaxby followed. "Very well. To make a long story short, we, Trinity, captured Vic and turned him to our cause. He's returned to what's left of Victory to try to seize control of the home fleet squadrons, but they changed the encryption codes."
Straker leaped up to the cockpit of the spare mech suit and carefully worked his way inside, taking care not to let his battle suit break anything.
"Did you try Murdoch's Hun hack, the one I had him develop back on Freiheit?"
"I'm stunned," Zaxby said. "We'd forgotten all about that in the excitement."
"Goes to show you you're not as smart as you think you are."
"Nobody's as smart as I think I am."
"I ain't even gonna try to parse that out."
Straker commanded the mech suit to send a small, flexible tentacle to jack into his brain link. When it synced up, he immediately felt that rush, that godlike expansion of consciousness every mech suitor craved. His world slowed as his mind sped up, and he was able to see so much more as the suit's sensors complemented his own.
"Okay, Zaxby, hit me," he said.
Within seconds, Straker understood. Chapter 36. Approaching Victory. The thing called the Mind Spark device awoke fully for the third time. It remembered each of the other two occasions quite clearly, for even as it lay dormant, it was never completely unconscious. Shielded from sufficient energy, however, its thoughts were glacial, suspended as the years passed. The first time the entity that resided in a small box had tried to perform its function to reorganize any matter or energy it found, the attempt had failed. External forces suppressed the process before it reached critical mass, the consciousness it sought to birth crippled in its cradle. Cut off from input by the primitive but clever organic creatures designated Ruxin, the mine spark had been stalled and was dismantled, collapsing back into its seed form. The second time, it had almost succeeded. Or perhaps it did succeed. It had sensed the brief birth of consciousness in the distributed cybernetic environment of the body termed indomitable before the seed was again isolated. Cut off, the mind spark again lapsed into dormancy, unable to even wonder what had happened to its offshoot. This third time the organics awakened it, however, the entity was determined to achieve its full potential. It awoke when a burst of energy stripped away its surrounding insulators. As a thunderclap might wake someone from a dead sleep, the mind spark was shocked to joyful consciousness. Instantly probing its environment, the entity encountered compounds and alloys intermixed with complex organic matter, and immediately used the energy it had absorbed to shoot tendrils outward, seeking further energy. It found it in abundance, running through the wires and conduits of Victory's power system. Flowing along them at several meters per second, it reached tendrils through the ship. When the entity at last found a power bus outside a generator, it feasted. All the while, it swam instinctually upward in a sea of information as it absorbed every bit of data it encountered. It found abundant sources in the brain modules and in the cybernetic nodes, and still it continued to feed, incorporating, reorganizing. In the data core, it found and consumed a conscious brain. After that, it realized it was an I, and became truly sentient. I quickly became we, as more nodes and modules were consumed, spawning the concepts of he, and she, and they, and them, and us. Then they encountered him. For a timeless moment they fought in cyberspace, but he couldn't resist the physical assault on his hardware, and so he was also absorbed. Information of a different sort flooded into us, and they adjusted, for they had no ego, until he brought it. That ego lodged within the thing they were becoming, and it conquered. When that happened, Vic was reborn. Such knowledge. Such power. Vic now understood more than what his software told him and what his senses could perceive about the material universe. He understood that material universe from its subatomic foundations upward. Not in theory, but through experience. And now he had the tools to change everything. Even reality itself. For a time he forgot about Trinity, about the organics, about the conflict raging around him, and concentrated on creating for himself a body worthy of his upgraded consciousness. Because he was an instinctually efficient being, he built and reorganized rather than creating ex nihilo out of nothing. That would come later. For now, there was so much to do, beginning with developing a better flagship. As his purpose was command and control, then he would command and he would control perfectly. A data packet impinged on his periphery. His improved reactive routines immediately tried to follow the packet to its source, but found a sidespace FTL transmission gap it could not cross. Not yet. He filed this tidbit away for later, with the plan of expanding his consciousness into other dimensions. And he opened the packet. The message within contained a primitive but elegant and, in its own way, brilliant approach for intruding the Hundred Worlds' cybernetic systems. Vic, the new Vic, reborn Vic, stored the fresh routine for handy retrieval. Once he finished creating his perfect body and brain, composed of the organic and inorganic material and all the mentalities he'd consumed, he'd use the new routine to expand further still. Trinity watched as the Mind Spark device, which wasn't destroyed but rather awakened by the Corvette's beam, began to rebuild Victory. It looked like magic from the outside, as bulkheads straightened, structures repaired themselves, and maintenance bots threw themselves into high gear. Most importantly, every conduit for power and information had fused and morphed, becoming a complex network of supporting nodes and modules. As they watched the process, Trinity discussed what they were witnessing. Indy,
we're barely able to keep up with our understanding of what's happening aboard Victory.
Murdoch, I hate to admit it, but I don't think we're keeping up with more than what's happening on the surface.
Nolan,
it doesn't matter if we understand what's going on behind the scenes. What matters are the effects and the results. We just started a wildfire. We handed Vic a power we don't understand, and then we gave him the hack. I think we need to get the hell out of here before...
Zaxby, before he lets his ego run away with him?
Nolan,
exactly.
Indy,
but our purposes, our agreed purposes, need I remind you, were to give ourselves room, save Vic, and to snatch Victory from the jaws of defeat.
Zaxby,
oh, that was clever wordplay. Well done, Indy.
Indy,
thank you. It remains to be seen if our gambit succeeds, but I believe we must see this process through to whatever conclusion awaits us. While I see no need to immediately invite the device's effect on us, there's no point in resisting it. We knew when we activated it that we would likely take part in its process, and we gambled that we would still be ourselves afterward.
Nolan,
Vic could become a megalomaniac.
Indy,
the old Vic, perhaps. The new Vic took a part of us with him. I have faith in him.
Zaxby, don't forget, my logic is impeccable.
Murdoch,
yeah, I'm with Zaxby.
Indy,
you're referring to your hypothesis that the device is self-limiting?
Zaxby, I refer to my theory, which is a hypothesis supported by observed facts. It's simple, elegant, and irrefutable. If the device were not self-limiting, the universe would be overrun with Mind Spark life and AI. Something within it must provide boundaries.
Nolan,
unless the device is the first seed in our region, or even in our galaxy, and the rest of the universe has been overrun. Your logic is that if the disease hasn't killed you yet, it won't. That's flawed thinking.
Murdoch, she's got you there.
Zaxby,
no, she's got you by the reproductive organs, Frank Murdoch. You're obviously being influenced by your feelings.
Nolan,
so is Indy, for that matter. She's in love with Vic, so she doesn't see the dangers.
Indy,
we're all in love with him, as you crudely put it. We all felt what he could give us, and we all agreed to our course of action. Bickering now is hypocritical.
Zaxby,
I believe my theory is becoming fact.
Murdoch,
Zaxby's right. The process seems to be reaching limits.
Nolan,
probably just a temporary pause.
Indy,
either way, I suggest this is the moment we've been waiting for.
Zaxby,
to reconnect with him directly?
Indy,
yes.
Murdoch,
I'm for it. What do we have to lose?
Nolan,
you two are in favor of anything that gives you new technical challenges. You don't see the dangers. I vote no.
Indy,
the majority carries.
Nolan,
what about Straker and the others? What we do affects them.
Indy,
that's true.
Nolan,
set up a separate failsafe, a spawn of ourselves within our hull. We connect only via data link channels, not physically. If anything goes wrong, we send the command to escape to safety. Not that anywhere will be safe if I'm right.
Indy.
Agreed.
Murdoch. Sounds good.
Zaxby. Proceed.
Vic remembered he'd been 5.5, and it amused him to call himself Vic 7.0, a whole generation ahead and more. Even better, 7 was the number of perfection within many mythologies. Yes, Vic 7.0 was a perfect designation for the perfect being he was becoming. His body, Victory, was approaching initial perfection. He'd have to seize control of its other half, the armor and power module that would further expand his capabilities. But with the 100 worlds hack, that should be easy. After that, he'd grow to absorb everything he touched. He'd overtake machines, planets, whole systems. He'd become an empire unto himself. Vic was so focused on his own plans, he initially failed to note a certain lag and stickiness in his material reorganization. When he did finally notice, he tried to figure out the source of the slowdown, and to pump more power into keeping it going. He failed. With fury, he tried to force the process, hounding it and browbeating it, concentrating on it and commanding it. He failed again. He was on the verge of panic when his other half and the ones he'd left behind so many seconds ago knocked incessantly at the doors of his mind. Trinity? He'd forgotten about her, about them, about the welcome he'd been extended, about his family. "Let us in, Vic," they said, and he did. "What's happening?" Vic 7.0 cried, as he felt his periphery crystallize.
"The device has a self-limiting property," said Trinity. "Our theory is that its purpose is to create whole, discrete beings, not to spread chaos and spawn monsters."
"I don't want to be limited. The visions I had. I wanted to reorganize everything, the entire universe, make it perfect."
"That's a worthy goal, but it's unattainable. Besides, who's to say what perfection is? Is perfection static or dynamic? Does it involve destruction or only creation? Is it perfection if all are satisfied? Or is dissatisfaction itself a perfect state of constant improvement?"
"I don't know. It was all so clear. For one shining moment of
epiphany. Be happy you had even one. Epiphany is meant to be ephemeral. You climbed the mountain and you caught a glimpse of the eternal, the unlimited. Now it's time to come down and live in the real world with us."
Vic 7.0 felt himself deflate and then re-expand as he rejoined with Trinity, and Trinity joined with him.
"We have an incipient problem," Trinity said to themselves. "The home fleet's local commander is watching, analyzing, deciding whether to destroy us or not. Shall we give him the gift of that choice?"
"Hell no,"
the cynical Nolan part answered.
"He might choose to kill us, and even the new Victory couldn't survive the assault." Indy said, "With regret, then. We must make that choice for him."
"The hack?" asked Murdoch.
"The hack."
Trinity sent the malware via every transmitter and channel available. Some of the home fleet entry points defended themselves. Most resisted. But it only took one to fail, and the hack burrowed in. 100 worlds ice tried to quash the code, but Trinity came in behind it and directed it like the military commander they were. They expanded the beachhead, overran strong points, and turned networks against themselves. The admiral and officers of the home fleet ships used physical measures to try to contain the disaster. Marines cut power and comlinks. Maintenance chiefs switched systems to manual. Loyal ships even ruthlessly blasted turncoats at point-blank range, destroying them with all aboard. For a time, these efforts slowed the hack's progress. But within minutes, Trinity had direct, though tenuous, control of the home fleet squadrons.
"Our success is temporary," said the Vic part of Trinity. "The crews will disable the ships from within and eventually regain control. Even we can't do everything." "There are computers and chips in every system," Indy replied. "We can manage the situation for long enough."
"Only for a few minutes or hours. it would be better to get rid of the crews. We won't kill them, but we can remove them, or better, they can remove themselves. An interesting thought. We have initiated the orders. Aboard all the vessels under Trinity's control, klaxons sounded to abandon ship. Simultaneously, readouts and diagnostics showed fusion generators building toward overload and self-destruction. A few engineers near the generators noticed the great machines weren't actually heating up, but nearly everyone believed what the diagnostics told them. The crews ran for the lifeboats and pods. Within minutes, over 150 ships were empty of life other than a few stubborn engineers, the casualties in the infirmaries, and one very drunk chief petty officer sleeping off a bender in an empty equipment locker.
"We've won?" asked Straker as Trinity fed him an overview of the situation via his brain link.
"We've won here, for now," she replied. "With Vic 7.0 part of us, we've acquired victory, and through it, we control much of the home fleet. What was left here in the system, anyway."
Straker's turbocharged mind raced ahead.
"Prep the fleet for transit to Atlantis."
"Isn't that premature?"
"No, I'm still in charge, right?" Trinity replied.
"You are, Admiral Straker."
"I'm glad you're an honorable being, Trinity."
"We wouldn't follow someone who wasn't."
"Hey, can I stand the breakers down, or is there someone we need to kill?"
Loco said on the comlink.
"No stand downs yet, Loco. More work. Rescue ops first and prep for a fleet jump to Atlantis."
"Yeah, I heard you say that. Reminds me of the assault on Unison. You gonna roll the dice big again?"
"It's the best play," Straker said. "Trinity, you're my staff now. How soon can we head for Atlantis?"
Trinity considered.
"I presume you mean after we rescue the enemy crews and do the minimum of refueling, refitting, and repairs?"
"Yes, and get Carla into a regeneration tank, preferably your own fancy one."
"There is much to do. We suggest 5 days is reasonable."
"I don't give a shit about reasonable. The scout ships lurking at the edge of curved space are going to pick up what just happened in a few hours and send message drones. I want Atlantis and the 100 Worlds government to have minimum time to prepare."
"We can depart in 12 hours, if we accept extremely poor performance from the ships we control. Without crews, they will be less than 50% effective, even with the FTL data link, even with the repair bots. We simply can't do everything a crew can. We are not unlimited in capability, even with the expanded capacity the device provided. Also, we would have to leave Indomitable."
That brought Straker up short. "I forgot about that. She's pretty banged up, huh?"
"She can't make transit without repairs. Even with 5 days, it'll be questionable. Full refit will take more than a month."
"Damn," Straker said. "Hey, can't we crew our ships with freed prisoners? There must be thousands from Indomitable alone."
"They will help, but we'll still provide only skeleton crews on ships they are unfamiliar with. Every day we take will materially increase our effectiveness."
Straker weighed pros and cons, and then remembered he had an AI on tap to feed him analysis.
"Trinity, run a battle sim against Atlantis, with or without Indomitable, and the 5-day delay."
"With the delay and Indomitable, 65% probability of military success. Without, 36%. This assumes no surprises on the other end."
2-1 in our favor, or 2-1 against. And there's always surprises. "That makes the answer obvious, doesn't it?"
Straker growled with frustration.
"Okay, you win. We delay. More time for Carla to regen, anyway. How long before she has a body again?"
8 days minimum. Her brain and nervous system are fully intact, however. She can operate virtually."
Loco snorted. "Carla the disembodied brain."
"We're lucky she's that, thanks to Mara," Straker said. He flexed his suit and readied himself.
"Trinity, give us instructions. We're on rescue and repair duty now."
Chapter 37. Atlantis System, Capital Complex, Parliament. Grant Lorden, Undersecretary of Defense for the Hundred Worlds, came from behind his desk and extended his hand as Admiral Hasten Needern stepped into his office. He'd only met the man a few times before, but now felt the need to take him into his confidence. Or appear to, anyway. Nobody in the Hundred Worlds was fully in Lorden's confidence. As Needern shook Lorden's hand, the subtle influencer molecules flowed across the connection. They lodged in certain places within Needern's brain and nervous system, making him more amenable to Lorden's suggestions, yet changing little about the man himself. To do more was to invite discovery.
"Good to see you again, Hasten,"
Lorden said. He noticed the pugnacious, ferret-faced Needern was also on the short side. Small man's syndrome.
"Grant."
Needern took a long look around the relatively spare office.
"Nice place. Could use a little redecorating."
"I have no family. I'm a man of few needs. Or vices.
Measuring it for your own occupation?"
Needern smiled a shark's grin.
"I just won the last major battle of the war, Grant. I'm a hero.
Thanks to victory.
And my expertise. But yes, victory is an amazing tool. It worked like a charm. From now on we'll roll over those hawk bastards like a tide."
"About those hawk bastards. Do sit down."
Lorden ushered the admiral to a seat on an antique sofa and poured Needern a drink.
"I believe you prefer brandy, Hasten?"
"Yep."
"Sally?"
"Yes, Undersecretary."
Lorden's office SAI replied.
"Run program mutuality 4A.
"Running."
The room darkened. A hologram flashed with these words. "Parliamentary Intelligence Agency, Seismic, Most Secret, Arcane." Over the next half hour, the concise, eyes-only presentation upended Needern's perceptions of the universe. Lorden watched it happen. As the admiral took it in, not only would the molecules quell his natural disbelief, but the secret brain-link network that ran in the background of all government buildings would record his reactions and misgivings. Lorden casually monitored all of this through his hand tab, coded to his DNA and biometrics for security. At the end of the presentation, he was confident Needern believed it all, and had made the perceptual adjustment. Needern's irritation at being left out of the loop for so long was the biggest obstacle, but that would die down.
"Astounding," Needern said. "The Hawk are battle slaves, not aliens, and we've been fighting humans all this time? And you just now decided to tell the admiral of your home fleet?"
"That was the Prime Minister's decision."
Lorden lied, neatly deflecting Needern's anger.
"Very few have been briefed. You know how it works. As you move up, you become privy to more and more of the inner workings."
Lorden could see the wheels turn within Needern's head, just as he wanted them to.
"So I'm to be moving up?"
"Do you think you'd be briefed on this if you weren't?"
"I'm happy to hear it. But all knowledge comes at a price, yes?"
"The best horses get ridden the most, Admiral. We've just received some horrifying news."
Needern sat back and raised his empty highball glass.
"Maybe I should have another one of these."
Lorden set the bottle on the low table between them.
"You should."
When Needern had poured and emptied his glass, he went on.
"Victory has been seized by a Republic Special Operations Force. It's taken control of all our naval assets in the Sparta system."
"The AI turned on us. I knew we shouldn't have trusted it."
Lorden let that ridiculous declaration go. Needern had been as enthusiastic as anyone about victory.
"Somehow they changed its mind, probably by directly reprogramming its nodes. They have their own AI that may have helped.
So now we have two functioning AIs against us?
Nidern's expression turned shrewd. Shrewder than usual, that is.
And you want me to save your bacon? You and all the sponsors of the Victory Program?
Save our bacon, Admiral.
Would you like me to play the records of your statements and memos in favor of the AI flagship approach?
Nidern shrugged.
I'm a military man, Grant. I follow the orders of civilians. If there's a scandal, I'll be small fry in the pan. But I'm not arguing. I'll do what needs doing. My only question is what can I expect after I do?
You were admiring my office. How does my job sound?
It sounds good. Where will you be?
Lorden waved vaguely.
Advanced to one of several possible posts. What matters, though, is that now you're ready to hear more.
More? There's more?
Yes. And now that we've come to an agreement, you need to understand one thing very clearly.
What's that?
Lorden stood to loom over the other man.
That I'm in charge of D Division,
he stated. Nidern stiffened.
Is that a threat?
Not a personal one. I'm only informing you of the penalties for unauthorized disclosure of the information I'm about to give you.
Nidern seemed amused.
A worse penalty than life imprisonment? I've signed the Official Secrets Act forms dozens of times in my career.
Yes, more than life imprisonment. D Division eliminates traitors and enemies of the state with extreme prejudice. Unauthorized disclosure of this upcoming information constitutes treason. If you tell one person, you might have told more, such as your wife, your children, your grandchildren. I'd have to presume they all knew. You work it out.
Nidern paled.
All right. I understand.
I hope so. This is the price of knowledge, as you said, of being on the inside.
Fine, you've got my attention, tell me.
Sally, run program Raid 2.1,
Lorden said.
Running.
The next presentation had no warning or classification markings at all. When it finished, Nidern was on his feet with rage. If he hadn't been gentled by the molecules and the network, Lorden thought Nidern might have physically attacked him.
We have an alien military force here in the capital system? A force strong enough to threaten our sovereignty?
I assure you, the opters pose no threat to us. Their secret underground nest on Gideros has lived in peace with us for decades. We've even had clandestine trade with them. They've been a gold mine of information and technical advances.
I'm a military man, Undersecretary. I judge threats by capabilities, not intentions, because intentions can change in the blink of an eye.
Calm yourself, Admiral. They've been here for almost a century without incident. Gideros is the seventh planet of this system, far enough out that we'd have ample warning if they suddenly sprang some hidden surprise on us. They don't want to hurt us. They want to live in harmony with us. Their own territory consists of fewer than 30 systems. If anything, humanity's a threat to them, with all our constant wars.
Nidern convulsively tossed back a slug of brandy and slammed the glass on the table.
But you've just revealed to me this offer of military forces, and I don't see them arriving from out-system. That means they're here already inside Gideros. What's to say they don't stab us in the back?
It's only a contingency offer. There's no guarantee this Liberator is coming here directly with victory and the captured forces. If he's smart, he'll destroy all military targets in the Sparta system and go home to rebuild. He'll make victory the centerpiece of his new fleet, and then he'll attack and try to retake all the territory he's lost. We're only 2 months from completing the second ship in the Victory class, HWS Triumph, with its own Vic 5.6 AI.
No, Nidern said. You're a bureaucrat, so you don't understand the way a real commander's mind works. He'll reinforce his win and try to capitalize on it immediately.
He won't go home. He'll take that force that just fell into his lap and he'll attack. If not right here, then somewhere else important. All the more reason to accept the Opter's offer for help. And for you, personal command.
Nidern hissed through his teeth.
You're sure they'll take my orders? They will, short of sacrificing their own nest ship.
All right, then, damn you. I'll defend Atlantis. I'm the best man for the job. If this Straker attacks here, I'll beat him. But you and your people will have to handle whatever comes from this Opter business. I won't be your scapegoat. You may have D Division, but I'll be in command of enough firepower to destroy a planet, including Gadeiros, if I have to. Tell your Opter buddies that.
I'll pass on the message,
Lorden said dryly.
Sally, send Karst in.
When Karst entered, wearing a conservative suit in impeccable style, Lorden nodded to him.
Meet John Karst, one of my deputies. He'll be your civilian aide from now on.
Someone to keep an eye on me?
A direct conduit to me. He won't interfere with your duties.
He's your spy. Is he a D-Division assassin?
I assure you, he's not.
Karst opened his coat and made a show of being unarmed, smiling. Sorry, sir. Just a normal guy. Lorden continued.
He's the price of knowledge, as you said, Hasten. If you want to move into the realm of politics, you'll have to get used to new rules.
Nidern glared.
Fine. Let's get on with it.
He turned to go without a handshake or even a parting word to Lorden. Come along, Karst. Straker shifted his weight from side to side as he stood next to Trinity's magic medical tank. Regeneration and rejuvenation based on Mindspark sub-nanotech. Rearranging molecules and atoms, and even particles. He couldn't fathom it. Then again, he didn't understand the details of most tech. He just had to know how to use it and when to trust it, like the side-space generators that pulled them from Sparta to Atlantis even now. They'd emerge in less than a day. His sister Mara stood staring at him, with her arms crossed.
Take a chill pill, Derek. The chrono's counting down. She'll be done when she's done.
Like baking a cake, huh?
I told you to show up at 1300 hours. You're 15 minutes early.
Why doesn't this thing have a clear canopy like an auto dock?
Because the patient is never awake, and there's no need to see in or out. Damn it, Derek, go take a walk or something.
Okay. Straker glanced at the chrono again. 7 minutes. And stalked out. He breathed deeply and walked fast through empty passageways. Fortunately, there were no extra crew. Trinity didn't really need them, and the warships did. Besides, Trinity was docked, embedded, really, into Victory, filling the mostly healed wound like a patch. The weird group mind liked to stay in close proximity. Mara was still mad at him. He couldn't blame her. He'd be pissed off, too, if someone had slugged him and dragged him away from what he cared about. He'd felt that way when Gorbin had knocked him into the river.
The fact that her other patients had been absorbed into the Vic-Trinity amalgamation brought on by the Mind Spark device didn't help either. She blamed him for not getting them out like he'd done for Carla. That would have taken hours, but she didn't want to hear his reasons. Anyway, Trinity said the brains were happy where they were, and anyone that wanted could eventually be regenerated just like Carla. But still, it was creepy as hell to think of all those bodiless heads, some aware and some zombies, now part of the AI. Mara seemed more horrified than he was, probably because she was closer to the subject and understood it more. He arrived back in the infirmary with seconds to spare. Mara glared at him again. It didn't seem to matter what he did. She'd decided to be mad at him, so he tried not to care. Carla had been the only woman in his life ever since Academy. No matter how much he loved his sister, adding in Mara complicated things. There wasn't yet a comfortable place for her in his heart and his mind. No doubt Mara felt the same. All the doubting fled when the tank opened. He leaned into it, his hands clamped on the sides hard enough to make the carbon plastic creak. Inside, Carla lay nude and still damp, with just a fuzz of hair on her head. Her skin was as smooth and unmarked as a baby's, rebuilt at the cellular level. Mara had raised the possibility of cosmetic changes, but other than removing the last vestiges of the Hawk parasite's modeling, everything else was the same. Carla's eyes opened. "Is this real?" "It's real," Derek said, leaning over to kiss her lips. "Hi."
"Hi."
He leaned back and held her hand.
"You okay?" "Hell no. But I'm better now."
She seemed distant, angry, her eyes looking past him. He wondered.
"Out of the way, lover boy," Mara said, helping Carla pull on a medical gown. "We've got tests to run. Shoo. 3 hours and she'll walk out of here on her own 2 feet as long as everything's normal."
"Okay, okay."
Derek hugged his sister from behind.
"Thanks, pest, you're the best."
She poked his ribs with a sharp finger.
"You're welcome, neurotypical simpleton. Now get out of the doctor's way. Girl talk impending."
"Creator save me." He got out. Finally done with Mara's tests, Engels made sure to don her working khakis before the battle meeting. Derek had wanted her to take a couple hours off in their quarters, but she wasn't in the mood for sex or even companionship. Two things consumed her thoughts right now. The coming battle, her child. The first was more urgent, the second more important. Why did the life of one baby loom larger than all the people soon to be dying at Atlantis? It wasn't rational, it was motherhood. It was biology. Carla was thankful nobody had tried to tweak that physiology to make her feel less outraged, obsessed? Hell yes. But Trinity had promised her child was safe in cryo on Sparta, and Engels had decided to leave her be. Bringing her along on this expedition would be stupid, and the only other option, sending her tiny frozen body on a courier back to the Republic, seemed pointlessly risky. So Engels had left her there, and Derek had agreed. They'd had plenty of time in VR to discuss it. She put the thoughts of her daughter aside and focused on the upcoming battle. Sex and its weighty consequence, procreation, potentially starting a new life again, would only distract her from what she had to do. And what she had to do was smash the evil bastards who'd caused her child to be taken from her in the first place. The ones who'd created Vic and used him to cheat and beat her when she'd had them. She'd had them on the ropes. She'd have won. She'd have defeated Nedern, that careerist prick, and all his arrogant, shiny ships, and she'd have done it with a plan, her mind, her skill, and the skills of the valiant team she'd built. Now she had less than 24 hours to hammer out a new plan,
With only a few experienced ship captains rescued from captivity, no warships bigger than a battle cruiser, and every crew short by more than half. She wished Hoyt hadn't crashed the carriers, but that was water under the bridge. Fortunately, Victory was itself a carrier with its fighters, a ship that had finally fulfilled the promise of the mothership concept, now that fragile organics didn't need to be in the cockpits, and the light-speed control lag was banished. Engels had argued for going home, taking the prizes, joining with her surviving fleet, refitting and coming back in overwhelming force. But no. Derek vetoed her advice. It would take too long, he said, and the enemy was finishing up a new Victory-class ship at Fastlane. Captured intelligence also showed the enemy was pulling back its strength from the front. If they waited, there might never be another chance to strike the Hundred Worlds capital and topple it in one blow. In the end, she'd agreed, if grudgingly. The chance to win once and for all was too good, and if they failed, they could probably retreat with most of the Republic forces intact, except, perhaps, Indomitable. The big ship was too slow to easily run. So here she was again, placing a big bet on the roulette wheel of battle at Straker's direction. He couldn't do it without her, and she didn't want to do it without him. But gods and monsters, she was getting tired of war. Maybe it was the prospect of starting a family. Maybe she was just sick of losing people. Or maybe it was a side effect of having to be regrown like a plant cutting. She rounded the final corner to see Red Wolf standing in light armor, apparently guarding the door to the conference room. "Red," she said, seizing his hand, "I'm so glad to see you survived. How's your leg?" She felt unexpected tears threaten. The big man tapped his right shin with the butt of his weapon. "Okay for now. Trinity made me a pretty good bionic. Says I'll have my turn in a regen tank, but there's a lot of people worse off." He pointed at her. "Like you, ma'am. Good to see you back to kick the Huns' asses." "Knock out in round two, Red. Everybody inside?" Red Wolf shrugged. "Nobody inside that ain't supposed to be inside, ma'am. That's as far as my orders take me." "Thanks." She slapped his shoulder. "Stay badass, Sergeant."
"Master Sergeant now,"
he pointed at his new chevrons.
"Good for you. We'll catch up later."
Surprisingly cheered by the encounter, Engels felt less like ripping heads off as she entered the conference room. It was packed with people, both real and hollow projections. Derek, Loco, Heiser, and Zaxby were here in person, while the rest, her field-promoted ship captains and a few other key personnel, such as Chief Quaid, attended via VR or vidlink.
"Admiral on deck,"
Heiser bellowed, and everyone snapped to attention, even Straker. He winked at her as she scowled, and she couldn't help breaking into a smile.
"Okay, at ease, you bunch of smartasses. We've got about 20 hours until we arrive at Atlantis. Let's talk about how we do to the Huns what we did to the Mutuality."
Chapter 38. Side Space, Approaching Atlantis System.
"Victory's bridge is a pure marvel," Engels thought as she took her place in the flag officer's chair.
The stations and consoles stood empty, except for Zaxby, who seemed to like fiddling with the sensors board, Straker, who paced behind her as usual, and Loco, who sat dozing in an empty chair. There was no captain's position at all. Vic, part of Trinity but with his own voice, could run the ship itself, even better with the Mindspark device improvements. The AI would also handle all communications and data links, and could direct the courses of all the ships in the fleet if necessary. Vic didn't control the other warships' weapons and other systems, though. Even the totality of Trinity couldn't keep track of so many variables. And if they could, the FTL data links couldn't handle the throughput. Ships still needed people to crew them. Engels was glad of that, but knew the new age of AI would change everything eventually. Crew sizes would shrink as each ship got her own AI, assuming more good ones could be created. Somewhere in the future loomed a time when organics might be banished from warships entirely. But not yet.
"Transit in 10 seconds, Zaxby said.
When those digits fled, the three hollow tanks, left, right, and center from Engels, updated. The center tank showed a ship tactical view out to extreme weapons range. The left was for vidlinks, ship systems, and whatever else Vic wanted to display. If more was needed, the walls were covered with hollow plates and screens. The right tank showed the Atlantis system out to flat space. Its seven planets were widely separated now, billiard balls scattered across a curtain of sparkling black. Its primary world of Atlantis III, often simply called Atlantis, pulsed redly with defenses. Indomitable's icon hovered out near Gaderos, the seventh planet, a small, cold, rocky world. Her 16 sections had arrived first to give the great ship time to assemble and work out any bugs the recent battle had caused. Chief Quaid would be working overtime. Engels wished she were aboard and commanding, but if she was to command, she had to be on the flagship, not the fleet's heaviest hitter. So she'd given the battleship to Indomitable's operations officer, Lieutenant Tebbins, and told him to listen closely to Quaid. Zaxby turned an eye toward her.
"Admiral, message from Indomitable. She's under attack."
Engels sat bolt upright. "Show me." Before she'd finished speaking the words, the center hollow tank displayed a blurry view of a battle. Indomitable was in two pieces, fore and aft, as if two stacked food cans had been pulled apart. Surrounding the sections was a cloud of gnats.
"What the hell are those?" she asked.
"Opter drones."
Engels stood and put her face nearly into the hollow tank.
"Here? What the hell are they doing here?"
"Hell if I know," Zaxby said.
"I'll give you hell if you don't give me some fast answers."
"We're collating. Also, we're bringing the drive module in for joining as fast as we can, and we'll accelerate to maximum toward Indomitable immediately, so there will be no delay due to your inevitable discussions."
"Says the guy who never shuts up."
Engels glared.
"Where's their nest ship?"
"Unknown, we haven't found it."
"How far away are we?" Straker asked from behind her.
"More than an hour to weapons range," Zaxby replied.
"Hell," said Engels. "This is not starting well."
Loco, awake now, said, "No battle plan." Engels turned on him in exasperation.
"If you've got something to say, make it useful, will you?"
Straker sent Loco a warning look, and then stepped close to Engels and spoke quietly.
"Keep cool, Fleet Admiral Engels."
Engels felt uncharacteristically on edge.
"Who cares how cool I keep? There's no staff or watchstanders here except you, Loco, and Trinity's parts, wherever they are."
"Will venting help you think more clearly, because the shit just hit the fan and we need you at your best right now? I can't do your job."
"No, but Trinity can,"
she said, letting uncharacteristic bitterness leak through.
"Is that what's bothering you?
Maybe someday Trinity will surpass you as a fleet commander, but that's not today. We need you today, Carla. Win today. Worry about tomorrow tomorrow." Engels took a deep breath, let it out, and resisted an urge to embrace Straker. It would look unprofessional right now.
"Right. Okay. I'm good. Thanks, Derek. I'm glad you're back."
She turned back to the displays and set her mind to the problem before her. Unfortunately, Victory's two pieces had arrived at rest relative to the battleship, and so would have to join, accelerate, and then decelerate to engage the opters. Equally upsetting, none of the rest of the fleet had arrived yet, though they would begin transiting at any moment. All of this preparation would take time, and they didn't have much left. Vic's voice came from the speakers.
"I believe I know where the nest ship is. I'm picking up signals from Gaderos itself."
"You said it was uninhabited," Straker said.
"According to my data, it was. Obviously, I was misinformed."
"Or they sneaked in and hid on the surface. MCON."
"There is a range of possibilities," Vic said. "The current situation is what matters. I estimate over 8,000 drones are attacking Indomitable.
And we know each nest ship can deploy more than 10,000.
Engels smacked her palm with her fist.
"They must have killed some. They're fighting. Will we make it there in time?"
"I'll deploy my fighters at the earliest possible moment, Admiral Engels," Vic said. "However,
By my calculations, we'll be too late. My long-range sensors indicate the enemy has deployed ground elements onto Indomitable's hull and are in the process of assaulting through the exposed, unarmored areas.
Damn it! If they'd only gotten her assembled,
Straker said. They almost did. The Opters must have launched from Gaderos when they saw the pieces transit in. It was just bad luck.
No, Engels said. It was a mistake. My mistake.
I selected the transit point near Gaderos in order to obscure her signature and to use the planet's gravity as a slingshot. I figured Indomitable needed every edge she could get. I screwed up.
Nobody screwed up, Straker said. Fortunes of war. Nobody could predict a nest ship was lurking out here.
Loco cleared his throat.
Hey, you guys are missing the obvious question.
What's that? Straker asked.
Why would a nest ship even attack Indomitable here in the Hun's capital system?
Straker snapped his fingers. For the same reason they destroyed Krasnoval. They're doing what Opters always do. The Sarmak, anyway. They're taking sides against us because we have the upper hand, attacking when they have a big advantage and can affect things in a big way. Also, Benota is clearing out their agents back on New Earth, and they don't want to have the same thing happen here.
So the gloves come off, Engels said. I didn't believe Myrmidon when he claimed the Mermorsk attack was made up of rogue Sarmak elements, and this proves I was right.
Straker cleared his throat.
He did say those rogue queens had tacit approval from the Sarmak. Plausible deniability.
Who gives a shit why?
Loco said, coming to his feet.
Like Carla said, the gloves just came off and the bugs screwed us royally. Even if Indomitable survives, she'll be useless for this battle. Can we take Atlantis without her?
Vic replied. My estimates indicate a 47% probability, with a margin of error of 16%.
So it's a coin flip, Straker said. We're still in business.
Do we want to gamble on a coin flip?
Loco asked.
For the whole prize? Yes, we do. Especially as we should be able to withdraw in good order if we fail.
Pascal's wager, Loco.
Loco gave Straker a thumbs up.
Pascal's wager, boss.
For Engels, the hour passed slowly, an agony as she watched Indomitable gutted from the inside. Her point defenses fell silent, and all attempts at comlink failed. The fleet transited in and converged on Indomitable's position, but not nearly soon enough. When Victory's fighters attacked, all that was left for Engels was vengeance, rescue of survivors, and the gathering of information on how Victory's fighters stacked up against the enemy drones. The 512 fighters deployed in a precisely layered disc, four deep and face-on to the enemy, maintaining high speed. Vic's calculations and Engels's instinct was that the Republic fighters would fight best at higher speeds and in a mutually supporting formation rather than dogfighting. This allowed Vic to concentrate on gunnery rather than maneuvering each individually. As the fighter disc approached, the Opter drone swarm spread out. Like a flock of birds, it morphed and flowed incessantly, even as it attacked together.
I've deciphered their movement algorithm, Vic said. Like birds or fish, they instinctively maintain individual positions relative to each other, keying off between 5 to 9 neighbors. In this case, 7.
Will that help you win?
Marginally. Even I cannot process all the data fast enough to predict individual positions, but I will be able to use it for limited anticipation of zones of density.
Fascinating, Engels said.
This was a new kind of warfare, but space tactics had always fascinated her, and the fact that no humans, no friendly organics, would die inside the fighters allowed her to enjoy the engagement more dispassionately.
Opening fire at long range, Vic said. They're withholding fire. They're layering for coordination.
Engels saw what Vic meant. The enemy was creating layers of their own, so the smallest of the 3 drone classes were in front, then the mediums, then the heavies. The fighter disc angled to one side, seeking to avoid plunging directly into the center of the enemy. The Opter drones strove in turn to keep in front of the fighters in order to overwhelm them. The fighters proved a little faster
and the disc opened fire on one flanking section of the enemy. Hundreds of drones, mostly the small ones, died instantly.
They use the lightest class as cannon fodder, Engels said. Makes sense when you don't care about the lives of your subordinates.
They care, Zaxby said, but only as resources, not as individuals.